Okay, my name is Luis Quinones. I'm the acting board chairman of the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. May I ask who I'm speaking with?
Charlie Amel.
Okay, sir. The next voice you will hear is that of the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson, and will be serving as the panel lead for your hearing. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Good morning, sir. How are you this morning? Good afternoon, sir. How are you this afternoon?
Good morning.
So you're appearing for the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I'm going to introduce you to the board members that will be conducting your hearing this afternoon. To my far left is the Honorable Luis Quinones, who's acting as the panel chair. Coming down the line is the Honorable David Neal. Immediate to my left is the Honorable Mrs. Gail Rittenhouse. So my name is Michael Johnson. I'm going to be acting as your panel lead today, sir. I am going to go over some information with you, sir, and then we're going to talk to you a little bit, and then we do have several victims that are here that will also be speaking at the same time.
Okay.
So just for the record, could you just please state your name and your ABC number for us again?
Sonny Amel, 107724.
Thank you, sir. So you're appearing before this board for an absolute discharge or parole to your next consecutive sentence. Is that your understanding of your appearance here today, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. According to the information that we have, sir, you are currently serving a life sentence for first-degree murder. If you are paroled to your next consecutive sentence, sir, you will be paroled to a 7-year sentence for aggravated assault, and then after that you have another consecutive sentence for aggravated assault. That's a 7-year sentence. Is that your understanding, sir?
No, it's an aggravated assault and a first-degree attempted murder.
Yes, sir, it is first-degree attempted murder. You became parole eligible. You will be parole eligible on June 19th of 2018 is your first eligibility date for parole. Sir, according to the inmate progress report that we have here with us, sir, looks like you have taken quite a bit of programming since you've been incarcerated, sir, including that you have received your GED since you've been incarcerated. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. You don't have any release plans at this time. It's a parole to your next consecutive sentence. But you have had some discipline, sir. It looks like in March of 17, you had a possession manufacturing, and then looks like in April 26th of 17, you had unauthorized smoking. Can you tell me what those were about, sir?
I believe the manufacturing was a foul ball.
Okay.
And the unauthorized smoking was, it was smoking indoors.
Okay. Then it looks like in October 26, 2016, you had a positive or refusal that was a major. Could you tell me what that was about, sir?
That was a refusal.
Okay. Is there a reason why you refused?
I refused because I was dirty.
Okay. So when you say you were dirty, sir, what were you using while you've been there incarcerated?
A few years back, I picked up a problem with opiates.
Okay. All right, sir. So according to the information that I have here, this is your first parole board hearing that you've actually had before this parole board?
Yes, sir.
Okay. To the pre-sentence report, you were actually charged with one count of first-degree murder, count two aggravated assault, count three aggravated assault, count four aggravated assault, count five aggravated assault, count six attempt first-degree murder, and you had a count seven aggravated assault, count eight aggravated assault, count nine aggravated assault, however, you went to trial?
Yes.
And after you went to trial, you were only found guilty of three counts, count one, first-degree murder, count four, aggravated assault, and count five, attempted first-degree murder, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so this was an incident that occurred. Were you 17 years old when this incident occurred, sir?
I was 16.
16 years old?
Yeah.
This is an incident that says that it occurred when you had a problem with the victim in this incident, and you guys were involved in a fight, that you were going to get into a fight after school, that you guys were going to have a fight at the school, but that was broke up by a teacher, and then you guys decided to go to Clay Canola area, in which the fight between you and the guy was supposed to take place. Says that when you arrived there, that you said that you were going to cap the victim. You then shot him with the pistol, hitting the victim in the left side of his chest. The other victim in here, Mr. Guano, saw the pistol, backed away, and started running. And after the shot, and at that time, you chased him and was waving the pistol at him. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's accurate.
Okay. So, sir, can you just kind of tell me, in your own words, what was occurring? Because I also read that prior to that, that there had been an incident involving the victim along with you where you guys had been in a physical altercation. Is that right?
I was more of a verbal altercation.
Okay. So, sir, tell us a little bit about what was going on during that period of time.
Well, I had been receiving threats through third parties in regards to other individuals, Brody and Clint Hill, and it had gone on for a few days, and then on Monday, when we came back to school, I tried to figure out who they were. I found Brody, and I confronted him on the situation, and that's when Clint Hill was introduced into the situation, and we got into a verbal argument in the hallway at school. And teachers broke it up from there. Me and Clint went to the principal's office, and we were questioned about what was the problem, and then we were released. We went to our last two periods of high school that day. I came out after school was over and was confronted by a group of people across the street from the vehicle that I was going to leave school in, and we were preparing to fight them, me, Riley, and Hill, and teachers broke that up, so we all got in the cars and went out to the desert where Clay all is, and you already said the rest.
Mm-hmm. So why did you have the gun, sir?
The gun was, it had been in my possession for a couple of months prior to this incident, so the gun was just for shooting. I was a kid.
So what happened after you guys got out to the area where you were going to actually have the fight? How come you guys just didn't fight and you wound up shooting the gentleman, the victim?
Well, when I walked up to the group, I walked up by myself. The gun wasn't out yet. It was in my waistband under my shirt. I approached Justin and I told him, if we're going to do this, let's do this now. And he looked down, of course, and seeing a bulge or something in my waistband, and he took off running, which I was left there facing the crowd, and that's where I started seeing things in the crowd that, well, I mean, it kind of scared me, and I told everybody to back up. A few individuals didn't. I pulled the gun, and I waved the gun at the crowd, and that's where all the other FBI assaults came from, and then I turned and seen Clint furthest to my left, and he was about maybe 15 feet away from me. We exchanged words, the gun was already out, and I seen a movement. Obviously, I'm the only one that saw this movement, and I reacted to it and I shot him.
So when you say you seen a movement, can you describe what you did, what you're saying you saw a movement, sir?
I seen his hand go to his waistband.
Okay. So did you think that he may have had a weapon or something?
Yes, and that's because prior to all this occurring, like in the few days leading up to it, I was receiving threats. And then when I was confronted with them, both in the hallway that day, me that if I mess with Justin, he's gonna kill me.
So when you guys were about to fight at the school, did you have a weapon on you then?
No, sir.
So what did you do, have a weapon in your vehicle? Did you guys have to ride out? I'm not familiar with that area, so the location where the fight actually took place, was that in the desert area? You had to drive there, or what happened? How'd you get
there? Yes, we had to drive there.
How far was it? How long did it take to get there?
If I had to guess, well, it probably took us maybe 8 minutes. It's probably about 2 miles out.
Alright. So at any point did you think about just not going there or going the opposite direction?
No, I have to be honest with you, I didn't think about going the opposite direction.
Okay. So sir, in your submission that you have, and I do see where you've taken quite a bit of programming inside here. I see some diploma that you have in here. Along with some other certificates that you have in here, it seems as though you've been pretty active in trying to program and do some things for yourself. How did you wind up getting these tickets that you received last year in 16 and 14?
I'll have to say that it's just a change of being on another unit. This is a higher level unit than I'm on now from where I've been. And the people that I've been surrounded with probably had an influence in it. I've had to struggle over a few things internally, things that have happened to people I love on the streets that are no longer in my life because they passed away, and I had a hard time dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. So, are you affiliated with a gang in a prison gang?
No, sir, I'm not.
So, could you just explain to this board or myself why, what's changed about you that's changed from your anger management from the time when you were 16, 17 years old involved in some of these incidents and now?
Well, obviously one thing is I'm 41 years old now. The other thing is I've had a chance to experience a lot of different things that are involved in life when you get older and actually meet people in here that have gone through different things in their lives and how it's played out for them, younger and older. I've matured a lot. I've gained a lot more responsibility as a man, even though I do have some faults still. I'm not perfect. That's the biggest thing I can think of that I've changed is internally I've changed. My way of thinking has changed.
Okay, so I know you've been in there since you were, I believe, 17 years old, or you've been in custody since 16. So this is your first hearing before this board, sir, that we've had the opportunity to actually talk with you. Can you tell us why you feel as though you should be paroled to your next consecutive sentence?
I have served the time for it, and my family is suffering out there without me there. I also want to have a chance to start a life and a family of my own. I'm going to be getting a late start as it is. I know it isn't owed to me. I'm not trying to say that, but I believe that the time that I've been down so far, it could be a lot worse. And I haven't committed any other crimes that are murder or anything of that nature since I've been in. And I just feel like I feel like I deserve it, to be honest with you.
Okay. So you spoke about your family, sir. Is there a reason why I didn't recall seeing any letters or information from your family in the report? So is there a reason why we don't have that and none of your family's here as you spoke about?
Well, for one, I just have my mom left, my stepdad had died, my grandparents had died, and other people that have passed away that were involved in my life growing up. And I was only told 2 weeks ago that was going to be going to a parole board hearing, and I had the understanding from a lawyer recently, within the past year, that I wasn't going to be coming up for parole, that I was going to have to wait until I served my next sentence.
Okay, so, Mr. Yandell, I'm going to see if the board has any additional questions for you.
Okay.
Does the board have any additional questions? So, seeing no additional questions coming from the board, there are several victim witnesses that are here that have come to speak before this board. I'm going to go to them, sir, at this time and give them the opportunity to speak before this board. I know there are several witnesses. Everyone wishing to speak? Okay. For those that are wishing to speak, we're not going to pick the order for you to come up and speak. You can pick the order that you're going to come up and speak. When you come up, just come up to the podium, state your name, and present the information to the board, and then we'll see if the board has any additional questions, okay? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Michelle Hill. I'm Clint's sister. So I wrote everything down because my emotions are pretty high. So like I said, I'm Clint's sister, and I'm writing a statement to implore the board not to parole Scott Yandell for the first-degree murder conviction. I remember September 20th, 1993, like it just happened. I was homesick from school that day, and my mom was leaving for work early to come home and take me to the doctor. After she left work, her boss called the house and asked me to have my mom call her as soon as she got home. When my mom got home, she called her boss, and her boss told her Clint had been shot. I remember the look on her face, the absolute shock. She hung up with her boss, walked in the bedroom, and started to call the hospital in Safford. She told me Clint was shot and that she didn't know if he was alive or not, but she wouldn't look at me. She called the hospital, and I was kneeling next to the bed when she spoke to the hospital. She shook her head at me, and I collapsed on the bed sobbing. I remember everything about that day. I remember my mom's face. I remember my grandmother when she walked in and hugged my mom. My aunt and uncle showing up to be with us. When my cousin Joey walked in, I was leaning on the back of the couch, and I remember the tears on his face. And I said, he's so young. I was thinking, how could he ever understand this? I was only 13 at that time. But my life changed in such a profound way that I never felt that way at 13 again. Clint's murder changed our lives forever. My mom was never the same. I don't know that anyone who was a child could ever be the same. There was always a sadness to her, regardless of what was happening. She never got over it. When I was a teenager, she was so protective. She was constantly worried something would happen to me. She would either keep me home to keep me safe or stay home worried and crying the whole time I was out. When I was older and I moved out, there were many mornings my mom would call to check on me. She'd call casually to chat, but it was really to make sure nothing happened to me during the night. Some mornings she would call crying, saying she'd been up worried all night. This went on for years into my adulthood. My mom had a heart attack at the end of 2011. The heart attack led to many complications along the way. She was in the hospital for 4 months before we were told the complications were going to take her life. And I have family, I have aunts and uncles who helped me through this time and helped me make the best decisions we could. But I thought about my brother so much when she was sick. What would he do? What decision would he make? I would think about how I wish I had him here to help me and to help my mom. When we found out that the illness was going to take her life, she decided to leave the hospital so she could die in her own home. She would tell us, it's time. I want to go home so I can go home and see my son. That meant she wanted to go home to her house so she could go home to God and see Clint. She said it was time for her to be with her son. One of the last nights she was in the hospital, she told me she was thinking about when Scott's parole date came. She told me that I had to be strong and to be there to speak for Clint because she couldn't be. I promised I would be here. It was a promise I didn't need to make because I would have been here regardless. But now that the day is here, I certainly feel the weight of responsibility to speak for Clint and for our family. My mom never spread or buried Clint's ashes. It was too hard for her. She couldn't decide what to do with them. She kept them in her closet where they were close but out of sight. And when she died, I laid them to rest together. Scotty and Bill took my brother's life. My brother's murder took a piece of our lives too. He took away my childhood and my chance of being an aunt. Clint's friends were never the same. I lost friends because my friends didn't know how to act around me, so they just stopped coming around, or it was too hard to be around me because it was uncomfortable. To this day, when someone asks if I have siblings, I usually just say yes, an older brother, and hope they don't have follow-up questions. I still worry about making other people uncomfortable over the biggest life-changing event of my life. It'll be 25 years next month, and yet Scott's premeditated actions on September 20th are part of me every day. The results of those actions have shaped not only my life, but the life of my family and the life of so many of Clint's friends. I want to have sympathy for Scott, and I wish that I could. I think maybe it would be easier on me if I felt sorry for him, but I don't. I have tried to understand what he could possibly have been thinking that day other than wanting respect. But the truth is, I look at his prison record, and I know he's been a violent offender. I see that he's not trying to rehabilitate and that he's a dangerous person. I'm asking the board to not give clemency to Scott on his charge of first-degree murder. Scott Yandell deserves to stay in prison and to continue to serve a life sentence for this first-degree murder charge. He's a violent man, and I worry for the safety of the community if he is ever to get out of prison. And the first step to keeping him in prison is to not allow parole for this charge. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Let me see if the board has any additional questions. Seeing no additional questions coming for the board, thank you. And who would like to come up next?
Hi, my name is Joe Gangemi. I'm the victim's cousin, but we grew up in the same house together, so ostensibly he was an older brother to me as well. I just wanted to hit on a remark that Michelle made about how the actions of that day cracked our family in half. Not just our family, but the families of everyone that knew Clint, his friends, Scott's family, and on top of that, that whole community of Safford. That day that occurrence happened, there was over 60 plus students at that quarry. And when bullets started being fired and that gun started being waved around, all those students from that school had their lives changed forever. I mean, essentially, that is a school shooting before the day and age of school shootings that we have today. And on the way there, he was said to have told people in the car with him exactly what his plan was to do that day. Those people that were in the car with him didn't get anything, but ostensibly, they're co-conspirators into a murder. And that murder has shaped generations going forward. Scott made the comment that he wants to one day get out so that he can help his family, then stating that he had his mother left. As Michelle was saying, Clint would have been very helpful to have around during his mother's time of need, and we didn't get that chance. In prison, we stated that he was dealing with opiates, alcohol, smoking, and no one asked where he thought he was changed. He said, well, it's not like I've actually killed anybody, but you're still breaking the law while in prison. And the effects that he has had on my family, again, like Michelle said, I wish that I had it in me to say, well, let's forgive, let's move on, everyone deserves a second chance, and I do believe that, but I believe that you have to show proof that you can be rehabilitated before you get that kind of generosity granted to you. So really all I had to say.
Okay, so does the board have any questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, my name is Sharon Roddy. I'm Justin Crotty's mother. Clint was living with us at the time that he was killed. I just wanted to point out a couple of things that Scott said just now that I have a dispute with. Number one, this did not have, this was not building up. As far as, to my knowledge, on Friday before he was killed on Monday, Scott, I don't think even knew Clint at all. And I don't think he and Justin even had a problem with each other. Justin had come home from school that Friday, and another student there at school, by the name of Troy White, had threatened Justin, told him he was going to kill him. Over that weekend, I kept Justin and Clint home. Justin was actually hysterical, thinking, we need to get out of this town, Mom. I think he's in a gang. And so we kept, I kept the boys home all weekend. They went to school on Monday. Apparently, Troy White had gone and mixed the pot with Scott. The problem didn't originally start between Justin, Clint, and Scott. It started with a third party. Somewhere over the weekend, Scott was brought into the mix through Troy White. And this is my understanding, that on Monday, Troy approached Justin at his locker and was, what do you have, why do you have a problem with me? So I don't think they even really knew each other. I think they had a class together. If it's, I mean, that's what I had been told at the time, but they didn't really know each other, had not had a problem with each other before that day. The other thing that I wanted to say was, there was testimony at the trial that the kids that were driving him out to Clay Knowles testified that he said he was going to have to kill them because they were disrespecting him and disrespecting his gang. That was actual testimony. The guys that drove him out there. So he, and they also testified that he said that because he wasn't 18 yet, he wouldn't get in that much trouble. And that was, I think, that is probably somewhere in the transcripts because it was testimony. Okay. And so, this, Justin went through 20 years of hell after Clint died. Suffered from PTSD, severe depression. He's only in the last few years began to work through all of that. And unfortunately, he didn't even know, they didn't even know each other. It was a safe face type of thing. As Michelle testified with Clint's mother, at the time of the murder, I had a, Justin was 16, I had a 5-year-old and an 18-month-old, and from that day forward, I could never, I was not unable to raise my younger children without constant fear. I would do the same thing that, and I didn't know Kathy was doing this. Anytime I heard a siren, calling my kids, just, oh, what are you doing? Just terrified that something had happened to them. I didn't let them walk to school. Even in high school, I didn't let them walk home. You know, I was just terrified. But the, you know, their growing up years were, was like they felt like they were just. So anyway, you know, it did affect many lives for many years. And I feel like, too, the comments that he would like to start a life of his own, that he thinks he deserves to start a life, a new life, and a new family. Clint was never offered that opportunity. I'm sure Michelle would like to have some nieces and nephews as well. And also, it doesn't seem like if he's been getting in trouble while he's been in prison, that he has not, that's in a very controlled environment, and he's not following rules in a controlled environment, what would he be doing when he is not in a controlled environment? That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you. Let me see if the board has any additional questions. Thank you.
Hi, my name is J.R. Bell. I wasn't there when this happened, but I grew up with Clint and Justin, and I prepared something to say here for this.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. On September 20th, 1993, I received a phone call that changed my life from then on drastically. Even though at that very moment, I would have no idea how much it would be changed. I had a very small, close-knit group of friends, with the closest of my friends being what I consider my best friend, Clint Michael Hill, and another very good friend, Justin Grotti. These guys were like the brothers I never had, and we had basically grown up together. The phone call was someone calling to tell me that my best friend Clint had passed away from a gunshot wound. I was not present when this took place, so I cannot comment on the actual crimes that happened. And as this person is convicted of these crimes they committed, it is fair to say they did happen. What I can comment on is how this terrible act of violence has disrupted and changed my life in many ways. You see, Clint was pretty much like my big brother, as well as Justin was, and we had known each other for over a decade at the time of his passing, and I can sincerely say he impacted my life in just about every way possible. At the age of 16, in the teenage years, us boys would actually have conversations about things like when we get out of high school, when we graduate, our adult lives, every aspect of it we would talk about constantly. And you always dream of doing these things together, and doing all the things you talked about, all those ideas and dreams went away on September 20th, 1993. I would no longer be able to get married and have my best friend be my best man and guide me through that event. I would no longer get to figure out what college to go to and ask for his advice, as I did so many times growing up. I would no longer be able to give him my advice on a numerous amount of topics, as I did so many times growing up. Our small set of friends were so affected by this tragedy that it just never seemed to be the same again between any of us. I can only comment on how I feel about my relationship with Justin changed drastically as this event affected him and his family in a big way as well. My best friend wasn't going to be there for me when my child was born to help guide me through and teach me how to be a good parent. The mother of my child was actually introduced to me by Clint when we were 14 years old, as he was basically responsible for every childhood relationship I ever had, as I was a shy kid and he would just force me out of my shell as he did most people, and be open and talk to people. I feel that my life would be drastically different had I had him in my life still to this day. Some might think or say that these thoughts are ridiculous, as we are not real family, but I had always felt like family to Clint, and his family were thought of as family to mine. I think about my friend and brother every day and have done so since that day, and that is all I can do because he was taken from me by someone who had no regard for human life, as it is shown by the life sentence that this person received. So I beg this board to never give this person parole from their life sentence, as Clint will never get parole from the life sentence that was handed to him by this person. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The board have any additional questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Hello.
How are you doing?
My name is Justin Grotti, and the This is probably one of the hardest days that I've had in 25 years. You know, looking at his face, it's the same face that told me he was going to shoot me. Pulled up with a gun in his belt, 44 Nighthawk with a 10-inch barrel. Got out of the car. He said, "Everybody get out of the way." And he pulled the gun. I went to fight Scott after school, not tonight. I wasn't going to fight him in a fist fight. We had no weapons. He pulled that gun out from about here to that wall, about 10 yards away. And I said, "Fight me." I take my shirt off, you know. "Fight me." He said, "No, I'm going to blow your fucking head off." Excuse my language, that's what he said. And he started zooming into my head from about 10 yards away. I turned and jumped, and I heard a shot. I did not know if he shot Clint at that point. I ran, and I looked back, and he was chasing me for about a quarter mile through the desert. Every time I looked back, he was like this. Zeroing in, I thought I was going to get a bullet in my back in any second. After about a quarter mile, I looked back, he wasn't there anymore. And everybody was scattering. There's girls who were throwing up. There's a kid laying on the ground in the fetal position, sucking his thumb. Cars everywhere. Everybody trying to get out of there. Everybody screaming. It was total just chaos. It was a nightmare. So anyways, this guy I barely knew, I think his name was Gabe. I saw him, I had class with him, but he was in his car driving away, and there's rows of cars, lowriders, you know, going, leaving. And I asked Gabe, I said, "Get me out of here." He said, "No, he's after you." I jumped in the back seat of his car, and I got down on the floorboard, and I said, "Please, get me out of here." He said, "Okay, just stay down." And he goes, "Man, that guy got smoked." I said, "What?" He said, "That guy from Phoenix, he got smoked, he got shot." So I asked him to take me to the hospital. He took me to the hospital and dropped me off. My mother, my five-year-old brother, 18-month-old daughter or sister were there. And you know, in the movies on TV, you see people get shot. You know, they have a chance to survive. You know, you hope for the best. When the doctor came out and told me that he didn't make it, it shattered me. Me and Clint, like JR said, we're best friends, like brothers. We grew up really poor, you know, in Phoenix together. And I mean, we clung to each other, we're brothers. And just the thought that he's dead, that, you know, there's nothing they can do. I lost him. They had to hold me down and give me a tranquilizer. My little five-year-old brother was screaming, "Clint's dead, Clint's dead, Clint's dead," running around there and grabbing him. And after that, a couple, you know, for the next 2 weeks, I was 16, we're living in Safford. Most of my family is in Phoenix. For the next 2 weeks, I had his little 8-ball gang following me around, pulling guns and saying they're going to shoot me, they're going to cap my asses. They told me. They followed me and Clint's girlfriend and her sister from there's a peace rally they did, like an anti-violence rally they did, where they did a march downtown. It was all real cute and stuff. But they followed me from that to my house, where we jumped out of the car. I grabbed both those girls, went in the kitchen, pulled the refrigerator out, and told them to get behind the refrigerator so they wouldn't get shot. I can't even tell you how much this changed my life. You know, I'm the man I am now because of this. Everybody back here, we are who we are because of this. You can't change that. But this moment, when Scott decided to shoot me instead of fight me, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm not advocating, you know, fighting after school or whatever, but, you know, that's one thing. Getting a fist fight is one thing. For you to pull out a 44 Nighthawk and shoot somebody from 10 yards away for respect or to save face, he was, I'm sure he didn't realize he was going to be in prison for the rest of most part of his life. He thought he was going to get out in a year. Because back then in the 90s, if you were under 18, you didn't get very much time. The gangs would recruit young people to do that stuff. I remember it very clearly. But he did it. He did it. And when we were in the trial, the trial was about a year later in Tucson. When I was in that trial, it was thugs from his church or that he knew sitting next to me and my mother and my dead friend's mother, giggling and laughing when they presented the autopsy photos of my friend with his chest cut open. It was a real funny joke. And Scott had a smirk on his face all throughout the trial until that judge looked at him and said, if you want to be a gangster, if you want to shoot people, we're going to set you as an example. You're going to go to prison for a very long time. That's when his face changed. And you know, through the whole trial, he made excuses. You know, just like a few minutes ago, he deserves it. Oh, nobody else saw the movement. You know, he was the only one with a gun out there. Nobody had a gun. I said, fight me. He lied, straight out lied and said, oh, well, he got out and he didn't show the gun. You know, he got out and pulled that gun out, pointed it right in my head and said, I'm going to blow your effing head off. You know what that feels like? It's not fun. And, excuse me. One thing that really stood out to me, I mean, I could sit here all day and tell you how my life's been affected by this. You know, I did have PTSD. You know, I did get diagnosed with that, and I refused medication. And, you know, I started using drugs. I used drugs for 15 years of my life after that, self-medicating, and I'm not making excuses for that. I've been clean for 8 years now. I'm proud of that. I help other people through programs to stay clean. But yeah, I carry my gun everywhere I go. When I was 16, I went and bought a gun off the street and carried it with me everywhere I went. I moved away from Safford, moved back to Phoenix, because my dad owned the tool business, Snap-on tool business down there, and they couldn't move. So when I was 16, I dropped out of high school. I was doing well in high school. I was in sports and everything else. I dropped out of high school, and I moved to Phoenix on my own. And I was scared to death that one of his 8-Ball Posse gang members was going to jump out of every bush. And that's how my life was. You know, even now, I think of, you know, I don't give victim services my address. I never have. I know how prison gangs work. I've been on the street enough to know how all this stuff works. You know, I know they have connections, they do things, they manipulate. I know how it works, and they play real nice when it's parole time. But if you let this guy out, if you even think about letting this guy out, I'm probably going to get my family to move out of state. I've been off the grid for 25 years. I don't have anything in my name. And that's my life. That's my life. That's my daughter's life. That's my wife's life. That's my mother's life. My mother, she's talking about the fear that she lived in. I can't even explain how bad it was. I mean, I couldn't even explain how bad and how paranoid. I mean, I can't even imagine what it's like to be a mother and have somebody try to murder your son and kill your son. You know, it more than changed my life. My kids should be playing with Clint's kids. You know, we did have plans, you know. I mean, it was a fist fight. And he cold-blooded, premeditated, murdered my best friend right in front of my face. And you know what? If he would have had his way, I wouldn't be here right now. It's a miracle for God that I'm here right now. And I don't know if Scott knew this. You know, the ironic part is 3 months before that happened, I fell off of a 60-foot cliff and broke my back and shattered my heel. I barely got off crutches like a week before I went out to fight him. I thought I was probably going to lose the fight, at least. At least. He probably would have beat my ass that day, and you know what? I would have taken it and it would have been over, but he didn't. He pulled a gun and he shot my best friend. He tried to kill me. When they found the gun, it was cocked and loaded with one in the chamber. They found it in the bush, the gun that is chasing me down. So Clint can't be here. The last thing that I wanted to do today was be here. I didn't want to be here. But I owe it to Clint. I owe it to Clint. Now to his family. My kids wouldn't be alive if Scott would have got his way that day. I wouldn't have children. They wouldn't be here. It's just, by the grace of God, it was a miracle. You know, he only had one bullet left in that chamber, and I think that's probably what saved my life, because he just wanted to make sure that was a sure shot. I thank you for your time.
Mr. Bailey, I know this is an emotional time for you.
That's okay.
My question, what was the original altercation? What was the fight all about?
It was like my mom said, it was this guy, Troy White. He was a big troublemaker. He took the Fifth Amendment at trial the whole time. He was going back and forth between Scott's gang and to us. He just started telling us he was going to cap our ass and stuff like that. And, I mean, I didn't know any of these guys. I was friends with everybody. You know, I was friends with the jocks. I was friends with the, you know, they called them the dirt heads. I was friends with, you know, the Mexican guys or the, you know, the whatever, the gangster trendy guys. I was friends with everybody, the jocks, everybody. This kid came and he kept going back and forth between me and Scott. He was saying he was going to kill me. And then going back and telling Scott that we were saying things about him. And instead of just having a conversation about it, you know, Scott started saying he was going to kill me. And, you know, they couldn't tell me at the trial, they couldn't say it. But, you know, he had a history of pulling that same gun on many people. That gun that he broke into a gun store and stole a couple months before that. He pulled that gun on several people. It just happened to be me that, you know, actually went out and was going to actually fight him. And, you know, I didn't think that he'd actually pull out that gun and shoot somebody. You know, I thought it was going to be a fight, and we had absolutely no weapons. But as soon as he got there, that lowrider pulled up, he got out, and he pulled that hand cannon out. Said, everybody get out of the way, just like that. And can you imagine that? Everybody get out of the way. And it's just, what? I said, fight me. No, I'm going to blow your effing head off from here to that wall, aiming at my head. And one thing I really want to say, you know, when he was up there giving his spiel, you know, about, you know, he deserves it and everything, one thing was missing. The same thing that was missing at the trial. Remorse. Not a bit of remorse. He never said sorry. Not once. To this day, I haven't heard him ever say sorry that he murdered my best friend and destroyed all of our lives. Never. Not even today. He didn't say one thing about I'm sorry. He made excuses and he lied about the fact that he said that he didn't get it out right away and he saw emotion out of the corner of his eye that nobody else saw. I mean, we had a trial. The trial was a week long. It was hell. And we went through all of this. There was, I mean, 60 people. There was a lot of witnesses on that stand. They said exactly the same thing. You know, it wasn't, the judge didn't do this lightly.
So I'm going to see if the board have any additional questions. Mr. Bradley, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else on the victim witness that wanted to speak? No. Okay. All right. So at this time, I'm going to go back to Mr. Yandell. And Mr. Yandell, the board is coming up on the conclusion of your hearing. During this time, the board would make a determination. We're going to discuss and make a determination whether to grant or deny your parole to your next consecutive sentence, sir. Is there anything else you'd like to say to this board without repeating yourself, sir?
I'll just ask the board to take your time and make the correct decision on what they believe is right. I'm not saying that anybody in this situation is wrong. That was rough to hear, and I just want to say that I did apologize when I finally got a chance to apologize and speak in court. And I mean, maybe he doesn't remember that, but I did. And that's all I ask you, that you guys just make the right decision and take your time making a decision.
Okay. So I want to ask you one other question, because I did ask Mr. Grotti the same question. What, in your mind, was the altercation that really caused this fight to take place?
I mean, Justin's right. It was I was told initially by Troy White that Clay and Justin were looking for me. Now, at first, there were no names involved. It was just there was two guys looking for me. And then it escalated further and further. But the thing is that I wasn't continually told by Troy White. I was only told by him one time. And then after that, it was by mouth of others until I confronted Justin that day in the hallway.
All right. Thank you, sir. The board have no questions. Okay, Mr. Yandell, the board's going to go into discussion, sir. While the board's in discussion, we will make a determination whether to grant or deny you parole to your next consecutive sentence. I have a lot of boards in discussion, sir. I'm going to ask you to remain on the phone so that you can hear the discussion taking place with the board. We will make a determination. After we make that determination, I will get back with you, sir, and give you the information and determination from the board, okay?
Okay.
All right, sir, thank you. The board is now going into discussion. We've had the opportunity to talk to Mr. Yandel, as well as hear from several of the victim witnesses that have come down to testify before this board. I do want to acknowledge that Mr. Yandel has submitted his current information, what he's been doing, that he has been taking some program. He did obtain his GED. We do have the certificates that we actually have here with him on his submission that he actually has here. So that he has been trying to do some things and take training and programming since he has been incarcerated, including, you know, thinking straight and brief interactions, domestic violence, along with several other classes that he's had, prison survival that he's had. He's also been involved with the follow-up ministries and programming that they've actually conducted since he has been incarcerated. I think those are all good things, and I want to commend Mr. Yandel for the programming that he's actually taken. This incident occurred when he was 16, 17 years old. When this incident occurred, he did go to trial. It was a jury trial that they actually had. However, I'm very concerned about the current activities that Mr. Yandel has been involved with since he's been in prison. Going back just to 2017 with the unauthorized smoking and possession of manufacturing, which was alcohol, as he stated, positive or refusal because he had started to take meth. He had a 2014, he had a possession of drug paraphernalia, positives or refusal, two of them. And then he also had a fighting, which was there. And ironically, and from February of 14 to March or April of 17, all the incidents that he was involved in, with the exception of the last one with unauthorized smoking, were all majors that he was actually involved in since he's been incarcerated. And that's a concern to me. But although he has taken some programming and that he's done some good things while he's been incarcerated, he has received numerous tickets, which are concerning to me. And because of that, I do not feel that we should grant Mr. Yandel parole to his next consecutive sentence or an absolute discharge. That is my opinion. However, I am willing to discuss and listen to the rest of my colleagues. Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'll keep it short. In addition to your complete summary, I just am concerned about Mr. Yandel's sense of justification in the incident. I think it's something that it just stood out to me that some of the victim supporters have talked about hearing excuses, and I thought I'm hearing something worse. I'm hearing justification for this awful, tragic shooting incident, this shooting murder, and it seems that in the telling, it's pretty watered down from Mr. Yandel, and I'm not comfortable about the prospects of passing him to his next consecutive sentence. Thank you.
Ms. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm just concerned about the, you know, granted this was a 16-year-old person, but none of the other 16-year-olds or 17-year-olds who were present that day chose to bring a gun. and I'm just concerned with the thinking process, and then, as you mentioned, the discipline that continued. There's a continued attitude that comes all the way through the prison career with continued discipline, disobeying orders, drug possession, fighting. So I'm concerned with that. Certainly, I would not be in favor of parole.
I agree. Yeah.
Therefore, I am going to make a motion to deny granting Mr. Gandell parole to his next consecutive sentence or a absolute discharge, and in doing so, this happened in 93, I am going to ask for a 1-year set off.
Second.
Agreed. Okay, motion by myself, second by Ms. Rittenhouse. Agreed, Mr. Jonas. Agreed, Mr. Neal. I am going to mark the reasons that it was a serious and violent offense, but there was a loss of human life. I'm going to mark also trauma to the victim, as Mr. Grello still has problems with that. I'm going to mark age of victim, as these were all teenagers when this incident occurred. There were multiple victims. I'm going to mark serious bodily injury. I'm not going to mark that because I have the death. I'm also going to mark history of continued substance abuse, history of assaultive behavior, poor institutional behavior, recent disciplinary infractions, I'm also going to mark poor or no release plan because there's no release plan, and that there's no family or community support. Those are going to be the reasons that I have for denial, unless the board sees some additional or have some objection. Okay. So, Mr. Yandell?
Yes, sir.
You heard the discussion taking place to the board. The board has voted to deny, you know, you parole to your next consecutive sentence or an absolute discharge. Also voted to do a 1-year set off, sir, which means that in about a year or so, you will be, they will certify you eligible to come back before this board, and then you would have another hearing in about a year before this board. Sir, did you hear the reasons for denial?
Yes, sir, I did.
Okay, so those are the reasons for denial. Mr. Yandell, I want to thank you for taking the opportunity for appearing before this board. Also, I want to thank all the victim witnesses for taking the time and opportunity to come out and present before this board. That is going to conclude this hearing at this time.